From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations and comments from the National Humanities Center. Her name was Colette. She was born in France in 1873. She died in 1954, and she wrote that love is one of the great commonplaces of existence, a sentence that might represent and summarize her books. Soundings now presents a conversation about Colette with Joan Hind Stewart, a scholar at the National Humanities Center, where she's writing a book about French women novelists.
Colette is a very difficult writer to classify, I think. She's someone who defies classification. She was a very exceptional writer. She seems to be the exception to every rule and everything she did and everything she said, everything she wrote. At the same time, she's a kind of every woman in the range of her experience. Her works tend to fall between literary genres. She was a novelist, but her novels also participate in autobiography, they participate in essay. They're very curious, kind of ambiguous mixtures. It's difficult to know whether a certain work ought to be called an autobiographical novel or fictionalized autobiography. Colette was neglected for a long time, I think. She was not taken very seriously. And it's only
because of the things she wrote about?
Partly because she wrote a lot about sexuality, but partly also because she didn't write about philosophy or politics or religion or morals or public causes. She was a very special kind of writer. And she wasn't taken very seriously, but she is now. Recently, she's been rediscovered. A lot of the credit for that, I think, goes to a new interest in woman's writing. Colette was very much a woman writer and a womanly writer. She says that her writing was the result of an accident. It was something that was imposed on her.
What was that?
Her husband imposed it on her. She married a man. Her first husband was this Willie, and he was 13 years older than she was. And Willie was a fabulously interesting person. He was very much an important figure in the Belle Époque, in the gay 90s in Paris. He was very well known. He was well known as an author of books. Unfortunately, he wasn't much of a writer of books. Willie had other people write for him. He had a host of ghostwriters. He called them his secretaries. He loved publicity. He was also a miser. He was eternally broke. Willie never had any money, in spite of everything. Or he never appeared to have any money. Colette tells the story of how she became a writer in a book called My Apprenticeships, which is the chronicle of her years of marriage to Willie. She says that one day Willie was characteristically complaining about money, and he suddenly said to her, "Colette, why don't you write down some of what you remember about your school days? Don't leave out the spicy bits. I might be able to make something of it. Money's short." Well, Colette had never before thought of writing anything down, but she always did what she was told. She was both in love with Willie and kind of afraid of him. So she went out and she bought herself a bunch of notebooks, exactly like the kind she'd used in school a few years earlier. She was a very young woman at this point. And she says that as she looked at those books, the heavy ruled paper and the red margin and the black fabric covering all reminded her of her days at school. And she once again felt the urge, the necessity of doing the task that was imposed on her, of doing her homework. So like a good little girl, she sat down behind the desk and she began to write. And she says that when she finished, she handed her husband a text that was closely written and which didn't go out into the margins. It respected the margin. She seemed to be very proud of this. So she shows this text to Willie, and Willie looks at it, and he says, "It's worthless, no use at all," throws it away. And off they go on vacation. And then sometime later, one autumn, she says, she remembers that Willie decided to clean out his desk.
And found this?
Found the notebooks, yes. And he pulls them out, and he says, "What's this? I thought I'd thrown them away." And he opens the first one, and he looks at it. And he opens the second, and the third. And he says, "I'm a bloody fool." And he grabs his flat-brimmed hat and he runs off to see his publisher. And Colette says, "That's how I became a writer." She began her career then. She insists very much on the fact that she didn't want to write, that it was an accident. She did it because she was told to do it. She did everything Willie told her to do during a marriage that lasted a good number of years.
Was she a feminist?
No, not in the current sense of the term. She certainly was not militant. She was not associated with any feminist movements. She was not interested particularly in women's rights. But she was a writer who was very concerned with women, who wrote a great deal about women, who saw them as as courageous, as morally strong, physically strong. There's a wonderful line in one of her very last books. She writes, in the context of the Second World War, she writes, "The will to survive is so alive in us women, and the lust for victory so physical." And I think in a certain way that sums up the way she feels about women. And in fact, throughout her books, the women are the strong characters. The men tend to be weaklings. They commit suicide with considerable regularity and disappear at the end, whereas the women survive. They're strong. They're earthbound.
So the interest in her would be women today, academics, scholars, general readers, looking back and getting a sense of what it meant to be a woman at that time, not so much that she has a message of feminism.
No, she certainly doesn't have a message of feminism in any sense that we now understand it. What it meant to be a woman at that time, and I think to be a woman at this time.
Tell me about some of the women in her works. Are they sex objects?
Oh, no. On the contrary, the men are. That's what's so wonderful about it. Let me tell you about the woman in her first work, this book that she wrote under Willie's orders. The curious thing about that, finally, one aside, was that when the book was published in 1900, her first book, it was called Claudine à l'école, Claudine at school. Mm-hmm. It was signed Willie. No mention of Colette. Her name never appeared on the title. So here she was. She'd written her first book. It had an extraordinary success. Mm-hmm. That Paris went crazy over Claudine. And this went on, moreover. There were three more Claudines, one in 1901, one in 1902, one in 1903. Three sequels, I mean. So it wasn't until years after she had been doing all this writing that she began to be able to use her own name. She tells another wonderful story about these early books. She says that after the success of the first Claudine, it was a succès de scandale, to answer your earlier question. Yes, it was a huge scandal. Willie loved the scandal. Willie just loved publicity. He loved notoriety. He wanted people to talk about them. He didn't care what they said as long as they talked about him. And after this enormous success, Willie began locking her in her room for 2 hours a day.
To make her write?
So she'd go on writing, yes. And she apparently did. She didn't rebel.
Tell me about Claudine.
Claudine is a schoolgirl, and we follow her through her last year of school. And it's very much an autobiographical novel because it's based on Colette's own experiences as a schoolgirl in a small village, a small Burgundy village called Saint-Sauveur-en-Puisaye. The adventures of Claudine are hilarious. There are lesbian episodes. There are not homosexual episodes, not male homosexual episodes in that book, but there are in some of the sequels. There are all kinds of scabrous situation. Claudine goes around listening at doors, creeping up staircases, hiding behind bushes.
That sounds gothic.
Well, in order to overhear conversations, and normally these are conversations of a sexual nature.
Mm-hmm.
Claudine has a kind of aborted lesbian relationship with the assistant schoolmistress, but she loses out to the schoolmistress herself, who can offer the assistant more in the way of better teaching hours and better quarters.
How explicit was all of this stuff?
Relatively explicit. We're a bit jaded now. I suppose by our standards it's not terribly shocking. It is rather funny, though, and it is rather lurid. These are not Colette's best books, I'd begin by saying that.
Mm-hmm.
Colette wrote over 60 or 70 volumes in her lifetime. A great many more novels followed, and her best ones date from much later, beginning in 1911 or 1912 and going right up through the last years that she was writing, 1940s and the early 50s. She was doing work that has a much greater, I think, and much more obvious literary value. The Claudine books, however, are not negligible. They're funny books. They're relatively well written. They certainly provide a certain number of insights into Colette's biography, which help us to understand her better.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not her best works. The very best novels are ones like Chérie, which she published years later, and which is a stunning story of a man who is a sex object. Almost everything Colette wrote is in some sense autobiographical. The essays, the reminiscences, the novels. One of her major novels is called The Vagabond, La Vagabonde, which dates from 1911. And this is a very autobiographical novel. It's the story of her career as a dancer and a mime. Another interesting thing about Colette, you know, is that she wasn't just a writer. She wasn't just a novelist. She was also a journalist, also a writer in that sense, too, and a reporter. But she was a dancer, an actress, a mime, and she was a beautician as well.
Hmm.
Can you imagine when Colette was around 60 years old, she opened a shop and began selling cosmetics?
Were these respectable things to do for
a woman
at that time?
No, Colette's life is actually absolutely punctuated with scandal. The first scandal was the scandal of the Claudine books.
Mm-hmm.
After the next scandal, I suppose, was her lesbian affair during the time after her separation from Willie, which was around 1906, and her marriage to Henri de Jouvenel, which was about 1912, she had a very obvious attachment with one of the principal figures of the Parisian lesbian milieu, mm-hmm. a woman named La Marquise de Belleboeuf, who was known by the name of Missy. Mm-hmm. And in fact, Missy at one point appeared opposite Colette in a pantomime at the Moulin Rouge. She was playing the role of a man, and Colette was playing the role of a woman, and they had to exchange a long, passionate kiss during this drama, which they did. And it was apparently a bit too convincing for some members of the audience, especially Missy's ex-husband, who was an aristocrat and had a number of his hirelings there with him. He was infuriated, and he stood, and they began booing and hissing. Willie was also there. This was opening night at the Moulin Rouge. He stood up and began applauding.
He applauded.
And finally, they both had to make rapid exits from the theater. It became quite untenable, and it was in all of the papers the next day, as you can imagine. There was that scandal, and then in general the scandal of Colette being a dancer, being a mime, bearing her breasts on stage. She tells another funny story in one of her reminiscences about playing a role in a drama where she's attacked by a man, and the director says, "Wait, stop, there's something wrong. You haven't quite got it. You need to let out a breast." And then there were other scandals, too, as she went along. There were more and more. When she opened the shop and began selling cosmetics, she was already a member of the Legion of Honor. She was an officer of the Legion of Honor. She was one of the best-known writers, not only in France, but she had an international reputation. The final scandal was probably the scandal of her death. Colette was refused a burial by the Catholic Church.
On what grounds?
She'd been twice divorced, and mm-hmm. she hadn't received the last sacraments. She'd apparently manifested no interest in receiving the last sacraments. Colette herself, I don't think, would have minded at all being refused a religious burial, but a lot of other people did. Uh-huh. Graham Greene, for one, wrote an open letter to the Archbishop of Paris, which appeared in a newspaper, and which maintained that she should have been granted a burial, and there was a great debate about it. There were a great number of letters exchanged on the question. She was granted a state funeral. In fact, she was the first woman in French history to have a state funeral. It took place in the Palais Royal garden, but she was buried without benefit of public prayer.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, her life was full of that kind of contradiction.
Let's go back to her writing, to the literature that she produced. What's at the center of her themes, her concerns, the issues that she treats in the relations between men and women?
Sexuality. But not in a lurid sense. Colette portrays sexuality, and especially women's sexuality, as something extremely normal.
Mm-hmm.
Her women tend to be vigorous, curious, aggressive, straightforward, healthy, robust, and they're very interested in men. And Colette portrays this in a way that makes it seem just as normal as any other activity, sewing, cooking, writing, so that the result is really kind of tonic. There's a certain equilibrium about her works.
Now, by contrast, what would be the standard attitude in other French literature or in literature being produced in England or America at the time? How radical was that?
I think that for a woman writer, it was relatively radical. And I think that even compared to women writers today, Colette stands very much apart because there's no anguish in her writing, no sense of defiance. Colette doesn't give you the impression that she's out there challenging bastions mm-hmm. of male ascendancy. Mm-hmm. She simply wrote about what she was interested in. And she was interested in women, she was interested in sexual relations, in all kinds of relations, relations between men, between women, and between men and women.
How did she feel about social institutions, for instance, the church, as it might bear on these sexual themes?
She says virtually nothing about the church.
She just ignored it.
She just ignored it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true as far back as her first book, Claudine at School. Claudine at School is a book about a very important social institution, the school. But the church, which is so often parodied in French literature, appears almost nowhere within its pages, one or two references.
Joan, where did Colette get her own ideas? You say that she drew on the experiences of her life. What is it that influenced her and shaped her? I mean, is it possible to trace things like that when you look at the literature she produced?
Yes. There are two great characters in Colette's life and two great characters in her work, and those characters are her mother and her first husband. Mm-hmm. We've talked a bit about the first husband, whose name is Willie. Her mother also is called by a nickname in Colette's writing. It's Sido. And much of what
S-I-D-O.
S-I-D-O. Her name is really Sidonie, mm-hmm. which is Colette's own first name, of course. Colette was Sidonie Gabrielle. Much of Colette's writing is organized around a kind of opposition between these two characters. Willie seems to represent Paris, bohemianism, deviousness, pettiness, miserliness, sophistication, experience, eros. Sido, on the other hand, represents the provinces, purity, wisdom, womanliness, goodness, generosity. Sido is the source of all wisdom. Colette's mother's real name was Sidonie Landois, and she was apparently quite an extraordinary woman, but in the final analysis it becomes impossible to separate the real Sidonie Landois from the character that Colette made of her. Colette grew up in a small Burgundian village in a very curious family. Sido was at the head of the family. Her father was a military man who had lost a leg in the Italian expeditions of the Second Empire. He was a tax collector in Saint-Sauveur. Colette had a half-sister and a half-brother from her mother's first marriage, as well as a brother. And she had a very happy childhood among all of these people. And that's one of the things that nourishes a great deal of her work. She was fascinated with children. She loved to talk about her own childhood, loved to talk about Sido. Although, you know, curiously enough, she didn't start talking about Sido until after her mother's death in 1912. She never wrote a word about her mother. In those first books, the Claudine books that I've talked about, the mother never appears. There's a father, but no mother. Colette seems to divide her experience into two major parts, the years before Willie and the years after Willie. She sees her marriage with Willie in 1893, when she was 20 years old, as a break with the past, a break with her mother Sido, a break with purity, with the provinces, with girlhood, with everything. In fact, she has a line in My Apprenticeships where she says, "I had to leave both happiness and my youth behind." And this break with the past is one of the things that most nourishes her writing. From then on, she'll speak a great deal about what Willie represented to her, what the discovery of experience and sophistication in Paris meant for her. And these will become very important themes of all of the books that she'll write. As she goes on in life, she'll become more and more interested in retracing her own deepest past, her own childhood in Saint-Sauveur, and contrasting again those happy days, those early happy days in a kind of lost paradise, mm-hmm. with the later unhappy days with Willie. She eventually got over Willie. They separated around 1906 and divorced in 1910, and she went on to write other things too. But as a character still, he turns up in other books. My Apprenticeships was written after the divorce with Willie, a number of years later. She was still trying to work all of that out.
Joan, what's she known best for?
To an American audience, the answer would be Gigi. I think that most Americans are familiar with the story of Gigi.
Thank heavens for little girls.
That's right. They've mm-hmm. seen the film with Maurice Chevalier. Maurice Chevalier, in fact, was someone whom Colette knew in her music hall days when she was touring France and working as a dancer and a mm-hmm. mime. Her path crossed that of Maurice Chevalier.
And that's about coming of age.
That is very much about coming of age. And Colette's whole life is made of curious symmetries. And one of them, I think, is the literary symmetry between the beginning and the end of her career. She started her career with the adventures of a schoolgirl of about 15 named Claudine. It was stupendously successful. Her last major work of fiction was published in 1944. It was called Gigi. It was about an adolescent schoolgirl. It was stupendously successful. And in both cases, the story is one of awakening to sexuality, to experience, going out on one's own. Gigi is a short story. It's a very funny story, too. When an adaptation of Gigi was prepared for the American screen, it was Colette herself who decided who should play the title role. And she was in Monte Carlo. This was towards the end of her life. She was very sick. She had arthritis. And she and her third husband, Maurice Goudquet, used to go to Monte Carlo yearly. And in the hotel lobby one day, she noticed a young Anglo-Saxon actress, and she looked at her and she said, "That's my American Gigi." And do you know who that was?
Well, I do, but you should tell our listeners.
It was Audrey Hepburn, mm-hmm. and that was a very important moment in the career of Audrey Hepburn.
Joan, what do readers in the 1980s, what should they know about Colette? Having said all of the things that you've said about her, What would you add to that?
I think Colette is interested in two of the things that we're rediscovering an interest in the 1980s. One is class structure, and the other is marginality. That's another one of the contradictions that defines Colette's work. Some of her novels are very deeply ensconced in a bourgeois world. Others deal with characters who are marginal.
Marginal in a social sense?
In a social sense, yes. Mm-hmm. In a sexual sense, in a social sense.
Apparently uninteresting types.
That isn't what I mean. I'm sorry. I mean characters who earn their living, like Léa, who is a professional courtesan, who was a kept woman all her life, who was not a member of the good bourgeois class.
On the fringe of society.
On the fringes of society, yes, this is what I mean. Characters whose sexuality is ambiguous, who have homosexual tendencies as well as heterosexual tendencies.
Let me ask you this, Joan. Does sex define humanity in Colette?
I wouldn't want to phrase it that way, because I think that suggests suggests a kind of trivialization of her work. But for her, sexuality is a very important human characteristic, and it's related to all of the rest. It's related to the intellect, it's related to morality, although Colette is not specifically interested in morality. It's related to all of experience. Colette is a great storyteller. She's one of the best storytellers of the modern period. She's very engaging. Her prose is masterful. And she talks about things that we're all interested in. Children and old age. She talks about personal experiences which are very easy to identify with, which are very easy to understand. Colette fascinates the modern reader by the way she describes the psychological relations between men and women. The very small movements which are so hard to define, so hard to describe, Colette sees them. And she talks about them, and she persuades us of their reality and of their truthfulness. She's eminently readable. Another thing I'd mentioned for the reader in the 1980s is that she's available in translation.
Good translations?
Most of the translations are quite readable. They're English translations rather than American translations for the most part, and many of them were done a number of years ago, but have been recently re-edited and reissued. And all of her major works are available in English translations, in fact, soft cover translations, so they're not horrendously expensive either.
You're listening to Soundings from the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond. My guest was Joan Hind Stewart, a professor of French at North Carolina State University and a scholar at the National Humanities Center, where she's writing a book about French women novelists. Soundings turns now to another topic by way of commentary about America's romance with technology and gadgets. One citizen, for instance, recently lays claim to the invention of a device that communicates with the spirit world. On that subject, here's Hal Crowther, who writes for The Spectator magazine in Raleigh, North Carolina.
In an absolutely straight-faced news story, Dateline Washington, D.C., the UPI reported that a 71-year-old man from Franklin, North Carolina, had introduced a device that enables him to speak with the dead. This intrepid Tar Heel, one George Meek, chose the National Press Club for the unveiling of the Spiricom system, which combines electromagnetic and psychic energies to open up two-way communication with the spirit world. Meek, president of MetaScience Foundation Incorporated of Franklin, calls it a frequency modulation system using supplemental audio tones. He assured the journalist present that a TV device, which would allow him to view the dead as well as hear them, was just a few printed circuits away. Part of his presentation was a taped conversation between one of his associates and a physicist who died in 1967. Spiricom, he said, was the result of 10 years of psychic research. Countless TV anchormen use the UPI account of Mr. Meek's invention for the lighthearted kicker that invariably ends the 11 o'clock news. There'd be fewer light hearts if Spiricom turned out to be the real thing. All religions would be hopelessly compromised, if not bankrupted altogether. Religion is based on speculation and faith. If it were possible to get the story on the hereafter straight from the corpse's mouth, there'd be no place for either. The faith that had come closest to the truth might try to capitalize for a while, but eyewitness reports would soon render the spirit world as exotic and alluring as Myrtle Beach. One night of listening to Christ or Martin Luther confess his errors on the Spiricom would silence Billy Graham forever. Historians would be reduced to stenographers and switchboard operators. If you wanted to know why Napoleon wasted two regiments at Waterloo, you'd call and ask him. Jack the Ripper, Lizzie Borden, Princess Anastasia, Judge Crater, and Amelia Earhart could, if they wished, clear up all of history's great mysteries in an evening's broadcast. Columnists and critics wouldn't fare well either. Who'd pay Hal Crowther to pontificate if he could get Aristotle, Mencken, and George Bernard Shaw for free? Scholars in all disciplines hired to interpret Darwin or Hegel or Shakespeare would become superfluous if the Spiracom permitted the original authors to speak for themselves. Morals would break down everywhere if Adolf Hitler proved to be quite as comfortable in eternity as Albert Schweitzer. I retain some affection for the George Meeks of this world because I think the spirit that drives them is similar to the one that drove Columbus and Galileo. But the explorers on this particular frontier always sound like poor literal souls who started looking for answers before they had any of the right questions. Their discoveries defy the loosest logic. Take the TV component that Mr. Meek hopes to add to the Spiracom. What image can we expect to see? Is Spiracom so tuned to our psychic energy that it will show us the dear departed as each of us wishes to remember him? Will we see him as he appeared at the moment of his death? In that case, I don't think I'd care to meet with Jimmy Hoffa or Gary Gilmore or Joan of Arc. Does the deceased choose his own eternal image for transdimensional broadcasts, or is there a cosmic media consultant out there, a makeup expert who chooses for him? Would we recognize or respect the Duke of Wellington at the age of 7 if that face turned out to be his choice? Mr. Meek and his friends are easy targets when they venture too far from their sheltering abstractions, but humorous use of him may be short-sighted. What if, and centuries of research had been focused in that direction, a breakthrough into the spirit world finally came? What if it's here already, and George Meek is the Galileo of the ether? The long-range results of that breakthrough would be catastrophic. Like the secrets of the atom, which we pursued with puppyish enthusiasm until they threatened to annihilate us, the riddle of the grave is a mystery that can't be solved without hideous consequences. It's only our uncertainties, our ignorance laced with wishful thinking, that makes our unnatural awareness of death just bearable. What if a voice from the ether, of unimpeachable authority, convinced us that death is dreadful and the afterlife an excruciating bore? What if we knew for certain that there was no God, no eternal Jesus or Buddha, no purpose, and no future except endless ethereal tedium? What if these departed spirits, from the kind of vantage point above all time and space that Kurt Vonnegut postulates, told us flatly that all our best efforts are mired in futility and terminated in agony? What if it develops that we're punished horribly for our slightest deviations from a universal code that no one this side of the grave has ever figured out? There are very few human minds that could continue to function with no hope and no exit. The result of certain conversations with the dead would be a spiritual crisis that would make the Middle East and even the nuclear arms race look like parochial quibbles and practical jokes. There would be a virtual end to suicide, that brave leap into the hitherto unknown, and an onset of mass insanity, the insanity of rats in a maze that never leads to food. It's possible, even likely, that George Meek is a lunatic or a fraud, but if I thought there was anything at all to his research, I'd vote without hesitation to have it suppressed. There are technologies, as Edward Teller and Hyman Rickover have warned us, that we can't afford to pursue. There are many kinds of knowledge, as Faust teaches us, that we obtain at peril to our souls. George Meek reminds me that there is a limit on my lifelong commitment to free speech and to unrepresented minorities. I don't care to hear from the dead. It's time they knew their place. It's essential to us, the living, to keep the dead in their graves and to keep them quiet.
Hal Crowther writes for The Spectator magazine in Raleigh, North Carolina. You've been listening to Soundings, Conversations and Comments from the National Humanities Center. This is Wayne Pond. Soundings would like to hear from you. Write to the National Humanities Center, Post Office Box 12256, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities.